Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Transportation Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, April 23rd, 2024. We are in the Barnes Committee Room, Room 124 of the Alaska State Capitol Building. Let the record reflect that the time is 1:05 p.m. Today we have President Representative McKay, Representative Vance, Representative Sumner is online, Representative Stutes, Representative Mina, and myself, Chair McCabe. The staff assisting us today are Recording Secretary Linda Jensen, Moderator Susan Quigley, and Angela Steffel, my committee aide. Thank you for your service, ladies, and sorry I didn't warn you before I banged the gavel. First, I'd like to say that our thoughts and prayers are with the aviators in the wreck in Fairbanks an hour ago, and we just hope that the for a good outcome, and we hope that the first responders and the firemen all stay safe. It's a DC-3 taking off out of Fairbanks. DC-4, actually, I think.
What is that?
Fuel hauling plane, twin engine, big thing. So if everyone could silence their cell phones, that would be great. We have two items of business today. First, we will hear the introduction of HB 217, the governor's bill with a short title of Commercial Passenger Vessel Environmental Compliance. It's actually a long title. And then we will hear HB 332, the sale of the Alaska Railroad, for the second time. So let's begin with HB 217. We have Commissioner Designee Emma Pocon, Legislative Liaison Chris Coneman, and the Director of Water, Gene McCabe, no relation, who is on the teleconference. Commissioner Designee and Ms. Keeneman, sorry, place your names on the record and begin your presentation.
Good afternoon. Thank you. For the record, I am Emma Pocon, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Environmental Conservation.
And for the record, Crystal Keeneman, Legislative Liaison for the Department of Environmental Conservation.
Thank you, Chairman. This is Emma Pocon again. I wanted to say thank you for taking the time to hear House Bill 217 today. The bill was poised to be introduced at the end of last year, and the companion was, in fact, introduced in the Senate side. We took the interim and the first part of session this year to really have some good conversations and get some feedback on the bill proposal, and had a lot of good dialogue. I've heard concerns about residents' confidence and compliance by the cruise ship industry, and a belief that there's a need and a desire for a credible regulatory program. I've also heard a desire for underway inspections and surprise inspections. I've heard that there are concerns with fishermen and others reporting suspected unauthorized discharges, and a number of other concerns. I wanted to share with you all today the effort that DEC currently has underway, what we are in fact implementing. We currently have our credentialed inspectors on board each vessel sailing in state waters. We are doing inspections in port of all vessels, small and large. And we are doing underway inspections of large vessels if they are registered as discharging in state waters. And we're also doing opacity method 9 readings for air emissions. And then, of course, some of you may be aware, we have our annual report that's available on our website and submitted to the legislature that details the oversight of the large vessels. Our team has voiced to me confidence in the compliance and enforcement program that they're currently implementing. I think that there are advantages to our approach over the Ocean Ranger program as it had historically been implemented. I think those advantages include the direct interaction of our compliance and enforcement staff with the vessels and vessel officials. I think there's value in that continuity over time of developing a sense for the vessel history and the culture of a particular cruise line. They also have training specific to the permit requirements. They have training with respect to the specific technologies that are in use on the vessels. They also have specific training around sampling methodologies and a number of other areas. And these are the folks that have the authority rather than to just observe practices on the vessel, they have the ability to say this is a violation, it needs to be corrected. We're also getting to small vessels. where we have, I think, seen some more challenges with compliance and where the technologies that are available to those vessels based on spacing requirements are not as robust as the tertiary treatment that we see in those large vessels. And we've seen some more challenges with some of those smaller vessels, so I think it's important that we maintain the oversight on that front. And a collateral benefit is that because we're not, among other things, spending money on cabins for ocean rangers to be on the vessels the entire season, we do have a little bit of money accruing on the site that can be used for the benefit of port communities in connection with the vessels. So we had proposed in the bill that that money may be spent on improvements to shoreside wastewater treatment facilities. I understand there's also interest in supporting port electrification. I like those potentials because they are both infrastructure proposals that would have a concrete environmental benefit that we can sort of confirm and is tangible. And so I wanted to also share, you know, as I said, the bill had been introduced or was poised for introduction at the end of last session. We're actually, following those conversations and following the feedback that we've received, we propose to, rather than repeal Ocean Rangers, which I think is reflected currently, we would propose to modify the program. We propose to modify it in a way that would expand the definition of Ocean Rangers to include our DEC credentialed inspectors so that we can get that advantage of the direct interface of our staff with the vessels and that their ability to sort of have that direct enforcement authority, and also to clarify access to the vessels. We'd propose to simplify the fee schedule. Currently, it's $4 per berth fee on large vessels for Ocean Rangers, and then a commercial passenger vessel environmental compliance fee that's based on a matrix for all vessels that averages out about a dollar. We would propose to combine those two into a single $5 fee per berth for the vessels. And then based on the feedback that I've received, I've also proposed that we would supplement our DEC credentialed inspectors and the oversight they're providing of every vessel with some resources to maybe contract out with entities that have marine inspectors or marine engineers that could supplement the current oversight that we're providing. So those are the concepts that we're talking about and that we would propose to bring forward to this committee.
Okay, Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it through the chair. So you were talking about the training. Who's going to provide the training?
Representative Stutes through the chair. Much of the training is provided in-house at DEC. Where appropriate, it may be something where folks go out to a conference or we have a great partnership with organizations like the Western States Project, where there is environmental compliance specific focused training that many of our staff take advantage of.
Follow up.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, and what is the anticipated time frame involved in this training? Any idea?
Representative Stutes through the chair. I'm not sure I understand your question specifically, so I'm going to answer it in two different ways, and we'll see if one of them hits the mark. So one of them is what would be the time frame for getting people trained from where we are currently? And the answer to that is we currently have trained staff on board that would be able to implement that. With respect to how long does the training take, I have a training schedule from our staff that outlines a number of items, and it occurs over the course of a year, is what it looks like. I would defer to, I think, our division director, McCabe, is online, and he may have more specifics to provide, but I would say big picture, we're looking at approximately a year's worth of training.
So it's quite extensive training then. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Representative Vance.
Thank you, through the chair. I have a series of questions related directly to the bill. So the first one, let me see if I can find the page that everyone can. Page 3 at the bottom, where it's talking about the environmental compliance fees of $5 per berth. Can you tell me what is the current fee? Do you have environmental compliance fees now?
Representative Vance, through the chair. So the $5 per berth fee is approximately what we are currently collecting and implementing. It's a simplification of a fee matrix. So currently we are receiving a $4 per berth fee for Ocean Rangers, just from the large vessels. And then from all vessels, there is an environmental a commercial passenger vessel environmental compliance fee. That's a matrix that depends on the size of the vessel, and that averages out to approximately a dollar per berth. And so when we combine those two, the simplified fee, which is approximately the same amount, is $5 per berth.
Follow up. Okay, so that leads right into the next. I'm seeing kind of the breakdown in the sections and just wanting to get an understanding on section 10. It's talking about small commercial passenger vessels, and this sets up a fee of $75 and $100. Is this per year? Is this, you know, per trip? How does this break out? And could you also describe the size of a small commercial passenger vessel?
Representative Vance, through the chair. So the small vessels are those that are 249 passenger berths or smaller. And I believe that this, I may call on a lifeline and see if Director McCabe has a sense for the specifics of Section 10 and the fee articulated for small vessels.
Wonderful, because I'll have a follow-up in Section 11.
Okay, so Director McCabe, did you hear the question and can you hear us?
I did, thank you. And for the record, this is Gene McCabe. I am the acting director for the Division of Water. And Representative Vance, through the chair, thank you for the question. The Section 10, let me just get there real quick on my copy here. And I'm sorry, could you repeat your question again on Section 10 while I was kind of trying to flip my pages to it?
Thank you. I'm trying to get an understanding of the current fees and what is being presented in the bill so that we know this is relating to the small commercial passenger vessels with the fee of $75 and $175. How often is this fee assessed?
Representative Vance, through the chair. Okay, I'm going to answer how it's currently assessed. Right now, as it stands, that $75 or $175 fee, depending on the size of the small passenger vessel, is assessed per voyage. And a voyage is essentially one complete trip from beginning at destination to end destination. And the way that the bill is envisioned to finally play out based on the feedback we received is to simplify that fee and roll it into the one fee concept where it would be assessed at $5 per berth per voyage. So I hope I've answered both what's currently happening and what the bill language would ultimately reflect.
Representative Vance, if I may.
Sure.
So if you look to Section 19 in the bill, that provision in Section 10 would be repealed with a delayed effective date. And so the idea there was that they were giving a year transition time for the small vessels to transition to the new fee structure.
Follow up.
And for the record, that was Ms. Pocon replying. Representative Vance.
Thank you. On Section 11, it states that the commissioner may jointly set a fee imposed on all commercial passenger vessels operated by the state. So obviously, I'm assuming this will be under regulation. And can you give an idea of what that's going to look like? I'm thinking of the Soldovia Bay Ferry in my district, for instance, that's a commercial vessel. I don't believe it reaches 249 passengers, but I'm just trying to get a picture of what this is going to look like and understand what you currently have and what's being proposed in the bill.
Representative Vance, through the chair. That concept is reflected in current statute. I think this is sort of a cleanup of the language. The current practice is that the fee assessed on ferries has been negotiated has long been negotiated between DEC and DOT to zero, and we don't have any intent of changing that practice.
Thank you.
Very good. Any other questions? So I might have a couple, if that's okay. So it's been a while since we've heard about the Ocean Rangers. They were in the news quite a bit the first session that I was here. So right now we're doing Ocean Rangers and inspectors. Or are we just doing Ocean Rangers, or are we just doing inspectors?
Representative McCabe, we are only implementing our credentialed inspectors getting out. We do not have the funding for an outside third-party contract at the time.
Okay, and so can you describe how the inspectors work? Do they ride on the boat? Do they get on the boat and ride between two cities and then get off?
Chairman McCabe, so currently we have the large vessels get a in-port inspection, and the inspectors will be able to get around the vessel, see what the treatment technologies are, see kind of how things are set up, examine practices to the extent that they're visible while the vessel is in port. And then for those vessels that are discharging, we have a second inspection underway, which will be from one port to another to kind of see what those operations are underway. For the small vessels, because the practices in port are not different than when they're underway, we are doing at this time only in port inspections for those small vessels because we're not getting materially different information between in port and underway inspections. That's the current practice.
Okay, thank you. And I just have one more question. So most of the big cruise ships these days, they're containing their sewage from start to all the way back to finish, right? I think we had a discussion with one of these meetings where one of the cruise ship guys said that they don't offload sewage in any of the, especially the smaller cities. It would overwhelm, even a city like Juneau. If you bring 6,000 passengers worth of sewage in here and try to pump it into the sewer system, it would overwhelm it pretty quickly, I would think. So my question is, how many of the big ships do we actually have to worry about?
Chairman McCabe, the large vessels are not discharging while they are in port. There is a potential for some onshore wastewater treatment facilities to pump out from the cruise ships. I believe that capacity exists in Juneau. I don't know whether or not it's being utilized off the top of my head. But the vessels are not discharging while they are in port. There are some vessels that are not discharging while they are in state waters at all. And there are other vessels that are maybe not discharging while they are in port, but they are discharging while they're underway in state waters. That's with respect to the large vessels. With the small vessels, my understanding is that, as I said, that their practices don't differ. They don't have the technology on board to differentiate between underway and in port. So they are sort of operating consistently, whether they're in port or underway.
Thanks. And I think when we say discharging, we're talking about treated, not just raw waste. Pretty sure from my time in the Coast Guard, I remember we can't just dump it over the side anymore. We actually have to treat it, and it has to meet some standards before we discharge it into state water.
Chairman McCabe, yes, that is correct. So for the larger vessels, they have quite sophisticated tertiary treatment on board. The smaller vessels are subject to best management practices, and I believe they have marine sanitation devices available.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can we talk about the Wastewater Infrastructure Grant Fund? I have a couple of questions about this, but on line 14, the first bullet point says money appropriated to the fund by the legislature. So where's the startup money in this fund coming from?
Representative Vance, to the chair. So there has been money that has accrued in the Ocean Ranger Fund since that's not been appropriated the last several years. I think currently it stands around $11 million. I would expect that our modified Ocean Ranger program would be less expensive than the historic program because we're not, among other things, we're not paying for those cabins for the entire summer for all the Ocean Rangers. So we expect that to accrue bit by bit over time. I think since we brought this bill forward, as I said, that there's been some dialogue around using those funds for port electrification, and there are proposals out there to use that accrued money for that purpose as well. And that potential would be a direct appropriation by the legislature, not the proposal that's in the current bill that is formulated as a grant program that DEC administers.
Follow-up?
Representative Vance.
So I could go on to more questions about that, but I want to stick with the bill here. My understanding with the last time I remember the conversation about the Ocean Rangers is that you were having trouble finding people who were qualified to fit that particular position, and that's why you've transitioned to having your own inspectors because it is more efficient. So with this, is it your intent currently as the bill's drafted that you'd have that roughly $11 million as potential startup to fund, would that fund those positions to do these inspectors to do that work and the municipal grants?
Representative Vance through the chair. So yes, that $11 million is in excess of what we need to implement or what we've been using to implement the inspector program. So that's accrued monies that are available for purposes that are consistent with the tonnage clause and other restrictions that are on that money that would be available. Yeah.
Follow up, Representative Vance.
So in this, talking about the grants available for municipalities that are trying to do preventative maintenance and things like that, obviously this wastewater is an issue. There's a reason that this language is there. What are some of the conversations that you've had with municipalities on their need?
Representative Vance to the chair. There's depending on the community, there's different challenges with the shoreside wastewater facilities. I know that there are instances where there were discharge violations that were concurrent with an influx of visitors to the community from the cruise ships. And so you've got more people coming through town, you have more people using the facilities, and the existing wastewater treatment systems on shore weren't kind of keeping pace with that. And there, like I said, the circumstances may vary for each community. I'll also say that on the federal level, and I think perhaps folks have seen in our DEC budget, there is a lot of federal money that are coming through for wastewater treatment facilities that have kind of expanded the options that are available for a lot of communities in terms of funding support beyond what we had sort of on the horizon at the time that language was drafted, which is part of the reason why when, you know, with the port electrification proposals being something that also would be eligible is an appealing concept.
Follow up. I'm seeing here that the language says that the department would be the one who would administer the grants. And there's obviously a few of the qualifications here, but what I'm seeing is that when you open this up, this is going to be really competitive because this is a lot of money. If I'm remembering the conversation, I don't think it was Ketchikan, but there are some of the Southeast communities that have really old infrastructure, and with the influx of people, they need to rehaul, they need to have an overhaul of their entire system. So I'm just curious as to the need within the department to be able to fairly administer these grants in a way that's going to prevent lawsuit, because this is a really big deal, and I can see the money being used quickly. So two-part question. One is just the internal infrastructure to be able to set up a sound framework for these grants. But the second one is, how do you see this fund being replenished to keep these grants ongoing as our cruise ship industry expands?
Representative Vance through the chair. You know, administering grants or loans or forgivable loans is something that DEC currently has in our portfolio for our facilities program. And so that concept and sort of what criteria you want to build around a grant application program is something that that DEC does and has existing competencies for. I do think that the amount of money that would be available through this, while being substantial in some respects, is not going to be an entire solution for all of the communities that need upgrades to their wastewater treatment facilities, which is part of why I think it's also important to acknowledge the the EJA funding and the other federal dollars that have come through for the state that we're also able to deploy for that purpose.
All right, thank you. I think I've taken a look at the fiscal notes and you've answered a lot of my questions. I'm like Chair McCabe, we're just trying to refresh our memory on the last time we had this conversation.
Great. Any other questions? Okay. Well, thanks for your presentation. Do we want to, is there a sectional analysis we want to go through? Should we put Ms. Keeneman to work or should, what's the will of the committee? Should we just dispense with that? And...
I don't need it.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like
the boss is arriving. Maybe we ought to do our job. I think that's probably good enough. I'll let you off the hook, Crystal. So thanks, Commissioner Designee and Ms. Keeneman, for your presentation. And seeing no other questions, I'm going to set this bill aside. And we will see what we can do with it in the next 18 business days. I think we'll take a brief at ease to change presenters. All right, back on the record, our next item of business is HB 332, the sale of the Alaska Railroad. This is the second hearing for this bill. Today we will hear a brief statement from the sponsor, Representative Sumner, who is online, and he will remain online for any questions. Then the Alaska Railroad will present a short slideshow and talk about their thoughts on this bill. So, Representative Sumner, can you hear me?
I can hear you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay, take it away.
Yeah, just in brief, as a reminder for the committee, the bill proposes a method of effectuating the sale of the Alaska Railroad. Since introducing the bill, I have had some folks contact me with some interest. They an outfit that he arranged the sale of the city of Cincinnati's Cincinnati Southern Railroad to Norfolk Southern for a sales price of $1.6 billion and reach out with some interest in an RFP. And I'm going to have continuing conversations with them. But quite simply, the bill, I think, represents the legislature the state wish to sell the railroad. I believe the best method of effectuating that.
Okay. Any questions for Representative Sumner or his staff, Mr. Bickford, who is here, ably willing to assist if you need a face-to-face? No? You sure?
I'm sure.
Okay. All right, so representing the railroad, we have Mr. Bill O'Leary, President and CEO, and Megan Clemens, the External Affairs Director, in person. And online, we have Clark Hopp, the COO, and Brian Lindemood, the VP, Chief Engineer, VP and Chief Engineer. So you can approach the hot seat, sir and ma'am, and we will see if the committee has any questions before we begin, and if not, you can start. So any questions? I'm shocked. Okay, seeing none, Mr. O'Leary and Ms. Clemens, if you'd like to place your names on the record and begin your presentation, that would be great.
Thank you, and good afternoon. For the record, my name is Bill O'Leary. I'm the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Railroad, and very much appreciate the opportunity to be here today, provide our perspective on what I characterize as a deeply impactful bill. Hopefully the committee has seen the letter that the railroad sent to this committee on March 28th after the initial hearing on this bill that we were unfortunately unable to participate in. Provide some good background that and some context that I think we're going to update a little bit later on here. Very much appreciate the legislature's concern about the state's portfolio of assets, and we think it can be a healthy discussion and benefit to the state to review its holdings from time to time and ensure they're being optimized. And certainly this bill certainly triggers that discussion, and although, I mean, there's certainly some, we have some concerns about the timing of its introduction, just with the number of the items we have going on at the moment. We appreciate that this is a public policy decision that the legislature and the governor need to have and consider. So our goal here today is to really ensure this committee is aware of some of the impacts that immediately come to mind as we look at this issue. There's a series of impacts out there that could have far-reaching implications to the railroad operations, its customers, its employees, the communities, and other stakeholders. So before kind of bringing some of these effects to light, worth a quick reminder about how the Alaska Railroad is currently structured, effectively the model that's in place. And it really is driven by two primary statutes, one federal, one state. And the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act was the federal statute selling the railroad, providing for the sale of the Alaska Railroad from the federal government to the state, purchased by the state. And then the Alaska Railroad Corporation Act, which is the state's version of that legislation, accepting the railroad and establishing it as a corporation, public corporation, wholly owned by the state but independent of the state, but with ties to both the governor and to the state legislature. Certainly set up to be one of the more unique aspects of it compared to other Alaska state corporations, state-owned corporations, is the fact that it's set up to be self-sustaining. So not a drag on the general fund, but we earn our own way through rail and real estate business lines. And we are responsible for maintaining our own significant infrastructure. And again, very much a unique model in state government. We operate very similar to private business, but we have many of the advantages of public ownership. So another key aspect that will become important a little later on in the discussion is just we're charged with being an agent for economic development in Alaska. And you know, our mission is to provide benefit to Alaskans, and rather than just a singular focus on the profitability of the organization. You know, we believe this model has served Alaskans well for nearly 40 years, and again, if the model were to change, we think that there could be some certainly areas to be aware of or areas to work through. So that brings us to this slide, and specifically related to House Bill 332. And really, the takeaway on this is without federal funding, real estate revenue, and some of the tax advantages that accompany state ownership, net income or net earnings that is, you know, would becomes the basis for maintaining the infrastructure, we believe would be difficult to achieve for a privately owned Alaska Railroad. And you see some of the sub-bullets under that. Our books are kept very similar to private enterprise. And last year, we are on a calendar year basis, 2023, we reported the highest net earnings since transfer from the federal government, and that was at $44 million. It wasn't that long ago that we had actually suffered some net losses, and that not even including the COVID years. But so very strong year for us in 2023. Incorporated in that, and I can get into the vagaries of all of the, you know, railroad accounting if that is really what the committee wanted to do, but is $51 million worth of Federal Transit Administration formula monies. And these monies are available to the Alaska Railroad due to its status as a year-round scheduled passenger provider providing public transportation. These formula monies would not be available to a privately owned corporation. But they would, and they would not come to the state in any other fashion. They would simply be allocated among other publicly owned railroads. Real estate is one of our three business lines: freight, passenger, and real estate. And real estate is very important to the Alaska Railroad in that it really buffers the business cycles that occur on the freight and the passenger side. Real estate has been a very consistent performer for us. Again, in 2023, the railroad had gross revenues from real estate activities of right around $30 million. Under the existing language in House Bill 332, the majority of this business line would not be available for the new private owner, as those lands that the lease and permit income is generated from would be transferred to the State Department of Natural Resources. One of the advantages of the railroad being under public ownership from the railroad's perspective is it is exempt from state, federal, state, local, and federal taxes. That would not be the case for a privately owned concern, and so they would be subject to those additional expenses. So again, the $44 million is something that, and there are a number of reasons, could all be talked about. I think we did discuss some of that in an earlier presentation here, but it could evaporate rapidly under if these changes were to take place. Compounding this issue is there are changes in the availability of and eligibility for federal funding and our tax status under private ownership. It would also impact the ability to, you know, effectively and appropriately maintain the capital or the infrastructure that we have through our capital maintenance activities, as well as further develop economic development projects. So private entities, with the exception of one particular program, are not eligible for most competitive grants. And as we'll show you shortly in this, we literally have hundreds of millions of dollars worth of grants in the pipeline, or rather grant applications in the pipeline supporting some of these rail extension projects. And, you know, really since the 1996 timeframe, over $1.5 billion of federal money has flowed to the Alaska Railroad. Additionally, the railroad has the ability currently to issue legislatively approved tax-exempt bonds for capital investments. And again, this was something that private enterprise would not necessarily have as a tool in its tool chest at this point. Our capital program is, we have a $500 million capital program planned for the next 5 years. And really, our needs are in excess of $100 million per year, just to appropriately maintain the existing infrastructure. I think it could be challenging, certainly, with reduced net income and unavailability of federal monies, as discussed, to continue the viability of rail operations.
Thanks. So maybe we could stop here so we don't have a whole bunch of questions build up. And I think Representative Stutz has some questions. I think I have some. So Representative Stutz.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that. Through the chair. So you said since 1996 you had how many, $500 million federal dollars?
A billion and a half over it, actually.
And how much new track did you put down with that money?
Through the chair, Representative Stutz, those monies have been used for projects to primarily maintain the existing infrastructure, the tremendous existing infrastructure. It's gone everything from docks to depots to maintaining the existing, you know, 650 miles of track. Certainly, we have, you know, done some, we have laid some new track for industry specific type of things, but nothing of the materiality of the existing or of the rail extension programs that we have been talking about.
Follow up, Representative Stutz.
So, am I hearing that the railroad's kind of been on a status quo situation, maintaining their equipment and making sure that the rail cars are in good shape over the last 40 years?
Through the chair, Representative Stutz, I would certainly not characterize it as being in a status quo situation. The condition that the railroad was received in, was purchased by, was one of almost unbelievable disrepair. I mean, just the federal government, for better or for worse, really did not know. I don't know if they didn't know what they were maintaining, but it was not maintained at an appropriate level. So there's been a significant effort over the past 40 years to, for lack of a better term, dig us out of that hole and really address the massive deferred maintenance backlog that we received the existing conditions in, or the existing asset in. Now, that said, with those monies, there have also been, as I mentioned, new docks built. There have been new depots built. There have been new rail cars purchased. There have been new freight cars purchased, locomotives, things of that nature. So there has been expansion, certainly. But again, if the question relates to the rail extensions that we've talked about at this committee before, they have not been, well, some of those monies were used for the first part of that. $104 million from the federal government was used on the Northern Rail extension.
One more follow-up? Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you said that there has been some extensions, but just not what we're talking about, say the Northern Rail, far out, and that. What exactly has been extended or increased even by, 50 feet in the way of new rail?
Through the chair, Representative Stutz, I don't have the all of the specifics out there, but I know there have been some. I mean, they've been more, what we call industry track to some degree, where we will put a piece of track into a customer's site off of our main line and like that to be able to serve that customer more efficiently. That's effectively what I was talking about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll wait.
Representative McKay.
Yeah, thank you. To the chair, Mr. O'Leary, I think it's probably fair to maybe put some more definition on the expansions that you have done. What is it, the bridge? There has been work done on the Northern Extension. There has been work done on the Port McKenzie Extension. It's just not exactly laying track, which would be the last thing you would do. But you have built the bed. And you have built bridges, and you have built pieces of that. Maybe, I'm trying to help you here a little bit. I guess you have invested in the future somewhat to prepare for those extensions. You just haven't got to the point of actually laying track, which would be the last thing you do, right?
Through the chair, Representative McKay, to be very clear, I accept help wherever it is offered, all right? And
I don't think that was... Very clear.
No, and I think it's an excellent point, and I appreciate that very much. I mean, so there we have invested $188 million between of federal money and state general fund money in creating the longest bridge in Alaska, a 3,300-foot bridge over the Tanana River at Salcha, which is an integral part. It was phase one of the Northern Rail Extension project. And similarly, roughly $184 million, somewhere around that, of monies, I believe, appropriated from the state to the Matsu Borough for the Port McKenzie rail extension. And so, again, that work was all done, and you are precisely right. No rail has been laid because that is the last thing to be done with those rail extensions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I heard Representative Sumner in there, so...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Sumner. I don't want those monies to be mischaracterized. That was not investment by the Alaska Railroad in projects. That was state money, and I just want that to be very clear. And I do believe that the cost to construct, because the railroad was involved in the design, was grossly overinflated.
Okay, thanks. Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair McCabe. Through the chair, to build off of Rep. Stutz's question, talking about the different federal subsidies, I'm curious with other railroads, because the Alaska Railroad is the only public corporation or one of the only ones in the state. Other railroads are privately owned. When they conduct their deferred maintenance, do they qualify for any local or federal subsidies, or do they maintain their own operations internally?
Through the chair, Representative Mina. So you really got the Alaska Railroad is the last, and to the best of our knowledge, the only railroad in the United States that has both freight and passenger service. So there's nobody else quite like this particular model. So the answer is different depending on whether you're talking about freight or passenger railroads. Primarily on the freight railroad side, most of the funding is derived what we call internally, meaning the railroads generate the funds that they need to be able to maintain their infrastructure appropriately. Very different story on the passenger side, as those are almost all, again, with the exception of Amtrak, which is, you know, heavily subsidized by the federal government, but the vast majority of other passenger providers are, you know, community or states or, you know, authorities in cities to provide passenger service. And almost all of those receive the type of monies that we receive, those FTA, Federal Transit Administration formula monies. There are, you know, some of the questions have always been asked, why doesn't the Alaska Railroad run a commuter service, an actual commuter service? And, you know, commuter services are highly subsidized by the federal government. I mean, anywhere from, you know, up to 90% of their operating costs are oftentimes paid for by the federal government. So, it is a mixed bag as to how different organizations or different lines of business fund their capital.
Thank you.
Okay, no other questions. Okay. I have a few. Go ahead, Representative Stutz.
Thank you, Chairman Cave. And this is, I should know this, but I don't. So when was the railroad purchased? What year?
Through the chair, Representative Stutz, January of 1985 was when it was, the purchase was consummated.
Okay, and you said since 1990, follow up, Mr. Follow chair? Up. You said since 1996 that we've got $1.5 billion federal dollars, correct?
Through the chair, correct.
So, and you were talking about the projects at Port McKenzie. Well, even if I gave them the benefit of the doubt, that's only $400 million. So I'm still, and maybe as we go through this, I'll understand a little more, but I'm still at a loss as to, I understand that it's not cheap to maintain, but I don't see any expansion. I don't see where the railroad is moving in a forward direction. Well, I do now because of the Seward situation, but that's brand new. But anyway, so I just wanted to make that statement because I'm a little bit confused. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. So I have a couple questions. And the first one, you said very early on in the presentation that you were charged with supporting economic development in the state of Alaska. What kind of grade would you give yourself for that charge?
Chairman McCabe, I think the Alaska, I don't know if I grades real well, but I will say the Alaska Railroad has done a good job of supporting economic development in this state. I think in a state that is bereft of basic infrastructure, to have a railroad, to have a safe, efficient, well-maintained railroad permits economic activity that would otherwise, in some cases, not occur, and in many cases would occur in a significantly more expensive and more painful manner for the customer and the end user.
very politically correct answer. So I'm curious, has the railroad ever taken advantage of any ADA loans? We're going to have a presentation next week from ADA on financing infrastructure development in Alaska. I know they have loaned much money to many of our state entities for, you know, taking a risk and developing a little bit to further along our resources. So I'm curious of you, if the railroad has ever taken advantage of ADA at all.
Yeah, Chair McCabe. So the railroad has spoken with ADA on a number of different occasions about things. Matter of fact, we are continuing that dialogue about certain other projects at this point. But to this point, we have not utilized ADA's abilities. And the reason for that is when we have gone for use of debt, which is, again, one of the tools that's available to the Alaska Railroad, we have the projects that have lent themselves to that kind of debt. The railroad is perfectly capable of borrowing at a, you know, really the same level of expense that if we were to work through ADA. So there isn't a tremendous ability to, or a tremendous advantage from the railroad's perspective to go through ADA. That could change depending upon the project and depending upon you know, the terms out there.
Other than the fact that the interest that you would pay on an ADA loan would accrue back to the state instead of a private entity. I think that's what you meant to say.
Chair McCabe, I'm always willing to accept help. Thank you. Yes.
So, and so that's kind of segues into the real estate market. And maybe you could describe how you make your money in real estate. So, in discussing last week, I think the sale of the piece to the city of Nenana, I think I heard somebody say, maybe Mr. Lindenbooth, I don't know, that you don't usually sell a bunch of land, that you don't, you know, you're not like a real estate tycoon out there making deals and buying and selling land, that it's land that you accrue. So how does the money come to the railroad, the $30 million or whatever it was that you said?
Chair McCabe, it comes in a number of different fashions. Again, at transfer from the federal government, 36,000 acres of land came over with the Alaska Railroad. Round numbers, roughly half of that is used directly in our operations, meaning it's part of our right-of-way, meaning it's part of where we have our shops, it's where we have, you know, just actual operating lands. There are other lands then available for other uses. And the model that the railroad has used and has used quite successfully is primarily to either lease that land or permit that land, if it's for a shorter need, to the private sector, to other governmental entities, to anyone that really, you know, can bring forward a case to do that. And we lease it by statute at fair market value. To that, we can do leases anywhere from 5 years up to 95 years. The longer leases, there have to be specific findings made as to why we wanted to do a lease that long. But it's something that I think has been very useful to the railroad in that, again, it provides those lease revenues coming in that are very consistent over the years. We also have a number of docks, and of course the Seward passenger dock, the Seward freight dock. We had a you know, the our existing, still existing but unused export coal loading dock, and we receive fees for the use of those also, and those roll under our real estate revenues.
Thanks. So I have two more questions. They might be a little bit off the wall. So Chrissy Grant, you're right in the middle of that, I understand. Is that, how's that, hopeful, not hopeful?
Through the, our Representative McCabe, we'll actually be talking about that in about another slide or so.
Okay,
here.
I'll wait.
That's acceptable.
Okay, I'll wait for that. And the commuter rail that you mentioned, what was the, it seemed to me there was a holdup on a commuter rail between the valley and the city, and I think it had to do with J-Bear. Is that still a holdup, or is that?
Chair McCabe, no, the primary issue is, in, well, there's a number of issues, but the least, the primary one is financial. I mean, in that it would be an extremely expensive service to run that, and given our, the last time we did the analysis on this, would require, you know, give or take in the 85 to 95% subsidy. So it would be a highly subsidized route. And it would, and the other piece about that is it can't be looked at in isolation. You know, you need to look at the last mile at the beginning of this thing to get, if it is going to be from the valley into Anchorage, okay, you have to have the parking and the infrastructure in place for to get people to the train, and then, you know, putting 300 or 350 people off in, you know, middle of December at our depot in Ship Creek, then, you know, having bus service or taxi service or whatever. It's not like everybody just walks up the hill and works on Third Avenue. So it is not something that we have looked at it seriously. We've put models together about this, how it would work, but it's the financial and logistical piece has been very difficult to overcome.
That's a fair point. Anchorage is always the problem, isn't it? Did I say that out loud?
I heard that.
I'm just teasing. I saw you over there kind of twitching a little bit. Yeah. So, I guess that's all. We can move on. You have a question?
I do.
Representative Stutz.
Thank you. I do have a question, and it tagging on to the through the chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In speaking of the commuter train, in the last 25 years, say, what kind of strides have been made for connectivity between Alaska and the lower 48, or has there been any made? Is there any interest in that? That would seem to me to be a win-win.
Through the chair, Representative Stutz. So one thing I always like to say is, of course, we actually are connected to the lower 48 railroads through our rail barge service. It's for freight and it's for movement of rail cars between Seattle and Whittier. So, but for the concept of a land connection, it's certainly been of interest in that, you know, really rarely does a couple of years go by before some group approaches us and says, you know, we would like to really talk to you and partner with you about what it would take to make a land connection to the Canadian railroad system, effectively somewhere, you know, around the Canadian border. And we have sat with each and every one of those and talked to them and explained to them our understanding and how this would work. The vast majority of them say, thank you for your time, and then don't call again. The group, the A2A group, which is the Alaska to Alberta group, approached us in 2016 and engaged in those conversations, and those conversations kept going, and they kept going. And it appeared, you know, this was a different type of group in that they certainly seemed to had done a significant amount of their homework. They appeared to have financial backing. They appeared to be much more, for lack of a better term, real than many of the other groups we had you know, spoken with over the years and decades. So we did work with them up and through, I believe, 2021, 2020 anyway, and, you know, really starting to do some detailed work on this, up to and including looking at land that would be necessary to go to the Canadian border, and starting to understand what would need to be upgraded on the Alaska Railroad system to meet the demand that they were going to bring for this. That abruptly stopped. Again, in whatever year that was, 2021, something like that. And that group has since filed for bankruptcy, and to the best of my knowledge, all their assets have been dispersed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anybody else?
Yeah, I think
Senator McKay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Got a couple of questions here. I guess trying to focus back on the bill. The bill before us, HB 332, talks about if we sold the railroad, it talks about there would be established a resource. Well, let me first say this. I know for a fact that for decades, the railroad has helped build the North Slope oil fields. It's hauled countless tons of casing, mud, cement, drill pipe, all kinds of things to support Prudhoe, Kuparuk, Alpine, and so forth. So the notion, and of course, all the coal that was exported from Usubeli to South Korea for I don't know how many years. So the notion that the railroad has not participated or has been limited in resource development in the state seems to me to be a little bit we're forgetting our history. It says in the bill we're going to establish this resource development agreement. It says we're going to unlock responsible, sustainable, and expansion of our state's vast resources. That's great. All sounds great. We're going to inject private sector expertise to make that happen. We're going to demonstrate the buyer's commitment to actively invest in expanding and improving the railroad to better facilitate resource development projects within the state. We're going to build new rail lines to access resource areas. Okay, that all sounds great. Mr. O'Leary, if you owned this railroad yourself privately and you had an unlimited reservoir of funds, what would you do to accomplish those objectives? Would you build a rail to the slope? Or, you know, would you extend it to the slope? Would you go to Canada? Would you go to Port McKenzie? You know, it's sort of a chicken and the egg. Build it and they will come, or let's find the resource and then build the railroad to it. But I'm having a little trouble. You know, the promise of this sounds pretty rosy. But can you give me some idea? You know Alaska. You've worked here, you know, or lived here for years. What would you do what would be the top three things you'd do to accomplish what this bill set promises?
Through the chair, Representative McKay, the top one thing I would do is exactly what the Alaska Railroad is doing right now, which is going after federal infrastructure grants and hoping to partner with others that see the benefit of having this infrastructure in Alaska. The Alaska Railroad, whether I owned it or the state of Alaska owns it, is not an organization that is of sufficient size or magnitude. There are very, very few organizations in the world, I think, of sufficient size or magnitude to go forth and make, in the instance of the Northern Rail Extension, a $1.7 billion investment to get you a portion of the way somewhere without a solid business case as to how some level of, if not return, would be achieved, but would some level of how this would be paid for and how the costs would be done. And I think that's a key point about this. You know, the railroad, and I think, you know, with the number of times that we've talked to this committee about the rail extensions over the past really 6 months or so on this, you know, the railroad is far from resistant to these rail extensions. But we have been hopefully very clear, and I'm taking a whole bunch of Ms. Clemens' time here in a moment, where her slides are going to be, that, you know, we cannot do this alone. And, you know, so you either need a business case that shows there is, and which is, you know, the Seward dock is a perfect example of this. We have a business case. We have a willing partner to, you know, make this infrastructure happen. In the absence of that, which we are still working to develop, but we have not been able to, you know, achieve that at this point, then it falls back to more of a governmental type approach as opposed to the private sector model that the Alaska Railroad is built on, that you do fall into the, and it's an overused term, and I'm going to use it anyway, the build it and they will come approach on this. And that's all well and good, but it's just not possible for the railroad. I mean, it's literally physically impossible. Nobody would loan us the money. I wouldn't loan us the money for something like that in the absence of a business case. So that's why, again, I think the idea of the federal grants approach matched by either monies from customers, users, or state investment is what makes the level of sense to move these projects forward.
Okay, I just was trying to kind of visualize what this bill might promise, Mr. Chairman.
And, thanks. So a couple things. One of the things that we are, the chicken and the egg thing that we're running afoul of, and we're seeing it right now, had we built to the North Slope when maybe we should have, when it would be cheaper, we wouldn't be struggling with how to get gas to South Central. We could put it from the North Slope on tanks and run it down the rail, right? So it's a case of we didn't do it, and now here's the egg ready to hatch, and we don't have it, you know. So same thing with Canada, you know. What if we do decide to build a gas line? Wouldn't it be a lot cheaper to run the pipe up on a rail from Houston or wherever they manufacture the pipe and run it right up through Canada on rail cars? It seemed to me to be a whole lot cheaper than ocean going and harbors. And
Korea and Japan's where most of the cases.
Yeah, well, even still, we could bring it into Port McKenzie if we were done. So we're struggling with, we're now kind of between a rock and a hard place, and one of our key assets, maybe the key asset in Alaska, is sort of halfway towards being able to help us. And I get that, you know, you have to have the money. I get that the state has to be a partner, but somebody has to drive this bus, and I picked you. So here we are.
We got the train.
Or train, yeah, that's right. Somebody has to be the conductor. All right. So we can continue, I guess.
All right.
Whose turn?
All right. I still have mercilessly one last slide to go here before I leave the room. So continuing on the theme here, you know, if private enterprise were to purchase this railroad, as you see on the slide here, you know, speaking in the passive voice, steps would have to be taken for them to achieve a net income, as these dollars that we talked about would go away. Their most likely things would be selling off assets, reducing non-profitable business lines, especially on the passenger side, and certainly in the increasing of rates, which all of which would be changes that we believe would be negative for Alaska and Alaskans. So, again, we're trying to expand the footprint in a reasonable fashion of the Alaska Railroad. Our concern is that, depending on how this would play out, some of these steps would actually result in a shrinking of the actual footprint. Final bullet that I really want to talk about here is just, you know, as a state-owned corporation, the railroad operates with a mission to support Alaska's economic benefit, and we have mechanisms in place to ensure responsiveness. Now, again, I'm not going to say that everybody is wearing their I Love the Alaska Railroad button every day about things, but it's something that, again, our mission is very different from that of a fully private enterprise, in that we are not there to simply maximize shareholder wealth, but we are there to be self-sustaining and to provide that service to Alaska. So, you know, our board currently is appointed by the governor. We have two members of the governor's cabinet on that board, and it's Alaska, so people are certainly not afraid to, if they have an issue with the railroad, to make that known at any level throughout state government, and appropriately so. And again, just the commitment to serve as an economic engine for Alaska, really, I don't think you could assume that would be the same priority of a private enterprise that it would be for the Alaska Railroad. So, I believe at that point there are other unknowns, which I can talk about, but I think I've probably overstayed my welcome on this slide for a while here. So I'm going to actually ask Megan Clemens, our she can introduce herself, to take the next couple of slides.
All right. Thanks, Bill, and good afternoon, everybody. For the record, my name is Megan Clemens. I'm the Director of External Affairs for the Alaska Railroad. And for this next section, we've had a bit of conversation already about rail extensions and their relevance to this conversation. But, you know, I'm going to spend a couple slides just talking about, you know, how we see how the railroad is really well positioned to contribute to those efforts, some of the limitations that we face, and some of the solutions that we are currently looking at right now. So to start things off with strengths, it's worth noting, Bill's already mentioned, but, you know, the Alaska Railroad is a strong believer in these rail extension programs. I mean, we are inherently biased in believing in the benefit and the importance of reliable rail transportation services in Alaska. You know, appreciate Representative McKay bringing up, you know, some of the industries where the railroad, I think, really has delivered a lot of benefit to the development of the state. And, you know, just as we look back over Alaska's history, I think you really see that in the growth along the rail belt. And we'd love to see that expand to new parts of the state and, you know, be able to unlock new resources and bring those benefits. So, you know, with that, we have taken a concerted effort in recent months to take that leadership role, Chair McCabe, that you were, you know, mentioning you're really encouraging us to step up to. And, you know, over the last 6 months, we have been talking about these rail extensions and reaching out for, you know, where we can partner with others, you know, what questions, concerns, support might be out there with the governor's office, with the congressional delegation, with the Mat-Su Borough, you know, with other local governments, as well as private industry, ADA. You know, we've run op-eds, we've done, you know, rotary lunches, chambers. We've been really trying to make sure that these projects are, you know, top of mind for Alaskans and really trying to communicate the vision for what the potential benefits could be. Because we realize it's been about a decade since, you know, work has happened on either of these projects. Maybe they've gone a little dormant in people's minds. So we've been really trying to take that role in making sure that these are top of mind for folks as we are thinking about future investment opportunities in expanding our rail network. Another strength that we bring is technical expertise and a proven track record on these sorts of projects. So, you know, phase one of the Northern Rail Extension was that longest bridge in Alaska over the Tanana River, and that was completed on time and under budget. Certainly, there are three more big phases of the Northern Rail Extension to go, but, you know, we feel like we had a strong start with that one and, you know, speaks to the expertise that we bring to this. And same with Port McKenzie. You know, we were working really well with the Mat-Su Borough and making great progress on that project before funding was suspended, but, you know, got about halfway through that. You know, again, we'd love to see that project completed and think that, you know, with prior involvement, certainly bring a lot of expertise to getting that project across the finish line. Another, you know, just key thing I want to mention, because I think sometimes it's easy to overlook, but, you know, one great strength that the railroad brings to these extension projects is the assumption that the Alaska Railroad will take on the ongoing responsibility for the operations and maintenance of any new rail infrastructure. So similar to our, you know, existing model of being a self-sustaining state corporation, once these tracks are laid, we will not be planning on coming to Juneau asking for general fund support in maintaining the rail line. That's something that we will be building into our business model, you know, to ensure that that is not a drag on state resources. Of course, as we'll talk about here, yeah, there's a difference between maintenance and the initial, you know, the upfront expenses of investing in getting that track in the ground. But in terms of the ongoing, you know, taking care of that asset, that would be something the Alaska Railroad would be looking to take on. And, you know, as Bill had mentioned already,
the Alaska Railroad, as a state-owned corporation, we do have access to some funding opportunities that wouldn't necessarily be available to a privately owned Alaska Railroad. And, you know, we are continuing to pursue those. So, you know, currently we're going after a couple of competitive grant opportunities, but certainly still looking and always open for conversations with customers. Because, you know, to jump ahead to the third bullet on here, you know, bond authorization is a great tool that the Alaska Railroad has to offer, that tax-exempt bond authorization, but that does require finding a customer. As Bill already mentioned, you know, we're seeing that work to great effect with our plan for the Seward passenger dock. $137 million asset is not something that the Alaska Railroad would be able to take on alone, but because we've identified Royal Caribbean as a partner, and they've been willing to step up and secure that debt, it's a large project that the Alaska Railroad is able to, you know, help bring that infrastructure to the state. And certainly, you know, if we could find a customer like that for either of these projects, you know, we'd be excited and we'd be pursuing those opportunities.
So let me ask you a question, and this is one that I thought of a while ago, but I forgot it when we were moving on. Did you go to Royal Caribbean or did they come to you? I mean, how did that work out and why couldn't it work out on the freight side for Port McKenzie, say? Or, you know, I have heard from dozens of people that said, yeah, I'd love to go into Port McKenzie if they had a rail. And, you know, then I hear from you, well, we would love to make rail to Port McKenzie if you only had a customer. So we are kind of left in this rock and a hard place. And, you know, I've told you this before, but you're the captain of the railroad industry, and we are begging you for help, frankly. And like you said, some of those bond and federal money wouldn't be available to a private entity. They're also not available to the borough, but they are available to you. So that's kind of what's driving our conversation right now, is we need your help.
And Chair McCabe, I mean, we understand, and we want to do this. We want to partner with groups. I agree. It's a chicken and the egg type of thing to some degree on this, and it's trying to – the problem with it is the barriers to entry are significant. It's large dollars. So, you know, having something that, you know, and I'm not, you know, not knowing who exactly – you know, talking about with people that are interested in using, you know, Port McKenzie, but there needs to be, again, sort of that business case there, or else we need to rely. I mean, there's two models to do this. And it's, I mean, I will say that, and back in the 2015 timeframe, 2014, when we, you know, before the funding dried up, you know, certainly there was a lot greater interest from potential customers coming out wanting to talk about this because it seemed real to them at this point that it was going to happen. And then when the funding did dry up and the you know, progress on the project stopped, that's when it went off. So it's one of those things. It really is a step function up. You know, you've got to be able to come up with that funding that and to be able to repay to the extent you're going to be repaying that, if you're going to be using bonds or anything like that. You've got to be able to show that you're going to be able to do that. And that's just, it's just challenging.
There is no doubt that it's challenging. So we had, I think the military has been to Port McKenzie almost 20 times, exactly 20 times in the last 6 months. The last one I happened to attend, I think there was a major there that was sort of running the show, but I don't think there was anybody there less than a 2-star. And there were people from Washington, D.C., senior executive level people. And so the military is very interested. As you know, the cruise ship passengers are starting to go into Valdez more often, which limits the amount of time that the military can push bullets and bombs through there. And so the military is a big customer. But, you know, it was a little frustrating that you weren't there, frankly. That you would have been a huge addition to that, saying, yes, we just what you just said to me. Yes, we will support you, military, general, you know. And I know you've had conversations, don't get me wrong, but, I mean, it was a big function. There was 28 people that came in on a Chinook. You could have got a Chinook ride. But point is that I applaud you for being a very good steward with the state's asset. But we have got to do something with that state's asset. So hence the idea of a sale. There's also people out there. There is at least one company out there that's interested in shorter line rail. And they claim that they can do the rail from Port McKenzie to Houston for about $440,000 a mile. And until I talked to him, I was sort of taking that $247 million to do 32 miles at face value. But, he might be interested in buying just the 32-mile section, and maybe we could convince him to do the Northern Rail extension. I don't know how that works in the lower 48 when there's two different railroads sharing a rail line, but how they charge each other, who gets what the pass-through is, I have no idea. But we need to explore all options, and this bill, to Representative Sumner's credit, is one option that we're exploring. So I did talk to Mr. Shively the other day, and we had a really good conversation. I'm open to anything that will get the at least Port McKenzie get rail to Tidewater, and then once we start generating revenue through that, and we can identify some customers, the Northern Rail extension. I mean, it would be a perfect economic corridor, a multimodal, whatever you want to call it, because Whitehorse has hydropower. We could run power from Whitehorse up around. That would be a perfect grid instead of an extension cord that we have now for power. So, Representative Vance.
Thank you, through the chair. I apologize if I missed this somewhere in the conversation, but at this point in the session, my brain's kind of overflowed. But have you put together a report on how much revenue would be needed to make like Point McKenzie and the Northern Rail Extension economically viable? Because right here it shows that you're pursuing the grants with the feds. You need a state match. And, I mean, the entire argument is it has to be viable. You have to be able to have the revenue to be able to maintain it and make it work and really legitimize the ask. So has that, if you have a report, has that been given to us to see what it would take? Because it sounds like to me we have a lot of people interested, but none of them on their own are large enough to buy in themselves. But if there could be a way that a lot of these smaller entities, if we could see, hey, they exist, but aren't coming all at one time. So is there a report that shows how much is needed to make this float?
Well, as a component of the federal grant applications, there is a requirement that a BCA would be calculated. And I don't know if this would get to your question, but that's essentially to prove that the economic and community benefits of the federal investment would exceed the dollar value of that grant. And so, we are going through each of these projects and trying to capture and assign a dollar value to, the economic benefits, the benefits of taking truck traffic off the road, if there are businesses that would perhaps start, shipping something over the rail line that doesn't have the opportunity to do that currently, if there's other environmental benefits, all of that would be captured in that BCA. That would be part of the grant application package. So that might speak to some of that question.
Follow up? So if you don't have a report, for lack of better words, of what it would take to make, a piece economically viable, how are investors supposed to know if it's something that they should be interested in?
And through the chair, Representative Vance, I mean, it really depends on how the whole thing is funded. I mean, to a large degree. I mean, if we're going to, it's something that would be, I don't mean to make it sound this simple, but it's math for us pretty much that we could do that effectively. If we were to go out and hypothetically take Port McKenzie at $275 million, calculate effectively what the debt service on something like that would be, And then, you know, that's, you know, again, over a 30-year term, I don't know what the debt service and $275 million is. I've got a calculator that can do that for me, but, I mean, it's, you know, $20 million a year, perhaps, as a, you know, for over 30 years. So we would need then revenue that would be in excess of the $20 million a year for just paying off the debt on this, much less, you know, doing something for the, you know, covering our operations and maintenance costs out there. So it really, not trying to be evasive about the question, we haven't, you know, done a report specifically that says what you're asking at this point. It could be done under any one of a number of different scenarios, depending on how we look at funding it. Again, if you were looking at $275 million, but, you know, $220 million of that is covered by a federal grant, well, then that equation becomes a little bit easier to stomach, or a little, and, you know, as you're trying to figure out exactly how much revenue you need, how many customers you need, what net revenues you're going to be able to have to put towards that that debt service.
Follow-up, Mr. Chairman. I think I may have reached the pinnacle of the contention brought by the legislature of if it's such a simple equation, perhaps that's what we're looking for, is for you as the railroad to put together, if we're funded, the different scenarios. If we're funded this way, this is what we need from investors, partners who can provide, we'll need, you know, this much in revenue. That means this many, you know, freight cars serviced this many times a week. If we're funded this way, this is what we need. That way, there's a legitimate picture in black and white what it's going to take, so that those partners who are interested, whether it's DOD or, you know, the local government, can say, hey, you know, there's people who are bringing barges and have freight that they it's clear for them, that says maybe this is a lot closer in reach than we thought. But right now everyone's talking in hypotheticals. So I think that may be the ask that that we're looking for, so that we have something in our hand to have that conversation and get the investors on your doorstep. Does that make sense? Is that, did I find the piece?
I think what you're looking for is a business plan. I think that's what we're all looking for, and how you would advance forward if you did get a revenue bond or an ADA loan, or, and I'd like to invite you to Penwar and Whistler this summer if you're interested in going. I know you know what that is. For everybody else, it's the Pacific Northwest Economic Region. They have all kinds of loans available. It's where I first met the Federal Railroad Administration guy that kind of set me on some of the sort of a jag that I've been on, if you will. So, you know, if you wanted to send somebody with me, I'm going. The borough port manager is going to go. I think Representative Johnson will probably be there, probably Representative Foster. So, have a number of, I think maybe even Senate President Gary Stevens is part of Penwar. So we are actively trying to find ways to help you, help us, help the state of Alaska through this, because we believe, I believe, as I know you do, that you are the key to unlocking many things in Alaska, the railroad. So
I have one more technical question.
Okay.
Thank you. And this is simply because I'm not on finance. So for the $55 million specifically to Point McKenzie, that would be a state, I'm assuming, let's just assume a state match. You came to the state. How does the railroad make that request? Does it go through the governor's office and it goes in the governor's budget? Or do you separately, lobby the legislature? What's the mechanism for you to request state funds, for instance, in looking for this match? Because I understand the way it works is that the feds want to make sure that we are partnering as the legislature. So how do you make that request?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, it can be done, I think, in a number of different ways. I mean, certainly there's the traditional governor's budget. I think it can be done certainly by any legislator who wishes. It could be done, the Alaska, the railroad can ask legislators. I mean, we have certainly you know, had this discussion with a number of different legislators at this particular point. I think as we've narrowed it down here to these particular grant opportunities and this particular time frame, we have perhaps not achieved ultimate clarity here, but we have achieved greater clarity than we've had in the past as to what the dollars may be for these particular programs. And again, these, you know, these match amounts are, you know, it's important in that title, it's a minimum out there. I mean, you know, to be more competitive, certainly, you know, greater matches are encouraged out there. You know, we can certainly, to your earlier comment, you know, provide, you know, the, as I said, sort of, and I mean, like so many other things I do, I was probably overly simplistic about this, but I mean, provide the math about what kind of revenues would be needed, what kind of net revenues would be needed after to, you know, service a debt of these kind of these amounts. And, you know, we can certainly do something like that. And Chairman McCabe, to your comment, yes, I am planning on attending PENWARS in British Columbia this July. And I think the only concern, again, just to reiterate, you know, loans require repayment. That's something that, you know, sometimes we've struggled with in at the railroad and making sure folks understand that. And in other venues, that, you know, it's very different than grants. So, and before somebody is going to loan money to the Alaska Railroad, they're going to want to see a cogent business plan that is going to show that their money is going to be repaid under the terms of the agreement. And so that's where the struggle comes in on this. So, I mean, the great thing about the Alaska Railroad is we can borrow. I mean, we have access to monies as cheaply as anybody in the nation, given our tax-exempt bond status here. But it's just a question of what is the quality of that repayment stream to will determine the expense of that that loan.
Would it be inappropriate for me to ask how much capital you're sitting on right now? I mean, how much we as a legislator can't have a dedicated fund, but you can as a business. So do you have capital cushion, whatever you'd like to call it, in the bank?
Through Representative McCabe, yes, we certainly have, you know, I mean, we have our bank accounts here that, I mean, we keep try to keep an amount for, you know, effectively working capital. But, I mean, the way we budget every year is we budget our what our earnings are going to be and then convert that to cash flow, pay our debt service out of that first, and then pay our match on our federal grants out of that next. And then the remainder of that becomes what we call our internal capital program. So, you know, our plan is to spend the earnings each year, and all of that money goes back into the infrastructure, into the capital. So that's the model. It's kind of a closed loop type of type of thing.
Okay. Did you have another question?
Do I need to have another question? I think
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair McCabe. Through the chair, this might be on the previous slide in the slideshow, just talking about either Salih, before that. I don't remember which one, but it's related to passenger lines and how some of them are subsidized. What are your most subsidized passenger lines?
Oh, I would have to imagine that our least profitable passenger line would be our Hurricane Turn Flagstop train, and that we operate for the benefit of Alaskans who live off the road system and rely on the Flagstop service to access their off-grid properties. You hate to, you know, speculate on what a private owner would do, but it would be hard to imagine that would be a service that a private owner would continue, you know, if not operating again with that, you know, benefit to Alaskans as part of the model. A lot of our winter service also is challenging. We do operate year-round, and we keep regular winter schedules. But again, ridership is, you know, dips in the winter months. And many of those departures are not profitable.
Follow up?
Follow up.
Thank you, Chair McCabe, through the chair, for the flag stop line for people who are living off the grid, do they have an alternative mode of transportation besides the railroad, or how do people navigate that?
It depends on how far they live and I guess what, you know, private, you know, means of transportation they have. Small ATVs can cross the river on the Trainman's Walk attached to the bridge, the railroad bridge north of Talkeetna. And so four-wheeling access is available to some of those property owners. But many further down the rail line, that's not a viable or practical solution. So in many cases, it is the rail line that they rely on.
Thank you. May I ask another question?
Of course.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, so going back to the bill, my understanding is that the bill does three things. At first, mandates an RFP sale process by specific date. The second part is requiring a resource development contract. And the third is for the state to identify and classify assets. So for the three components of this bill, is a bill needed to do those three things?
Through the chair, Representative Mina, no.
Okay, follow up?
Follow up. I knew that was coming.
Through the chair, in terms of different investors that might have shown interest in purchasing the railroad in the past, how often has that happened and what was the culmination of those interests?
Through the chair, Representative Mina. So I've been with the railroad nearly 23 years, and there were certainly prior to my arrival, my understanding was the legislature looked at selling the railroad, and there was a group that was, you know, interested. And you know, at the end of the day, that didn't come to pass. In the time that I have been here, I am aware of one group that has contacted us to talk to us about this. This is probably 7 or 8 years ago, would be my guess. We came in, we met with them and their representative. We, you know, talked to them and gave about, you know, effectively what the railroad was about, and we gave them a tour of some of the facilities and asked them if there was effectively, you know, what else would they like to know about this. They thanked us for our time, and that was the last we ever heard of them, and that's been to the extent of my experience over the past you know, different roles over the past 23 years.
One last follow up.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, and this might be for the bill sponsor. So, looking at page 1, line 9 of the bill, it states that this RFP must enter into an agreement by the governor to sell the railroad on or before February 15th, 2025. If that date happens, what occurs if there is no interested investor?
I think that was for Representative Sumner. Yeah. Representative Sumner, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, I suppose there would be no sale.
Thank you.
Okay. And I think you had one more slide left, Ms. Clemens, or were you at the end?
I think we were. Well, you know, we didn't really get a ton into the details here, but I mean, you all can see the overview of the different federal funding sources that we are currently pursuing. So we have a $50 million congressionally directed spending request in to support the Northern Rail Extension, as well as a complementary mega grant application that we are currently working on. And then that FRA CRISI grant identified for Port McKenzie.
Cool.
And really, I had all sorts of great plans about a big finish here, all of which is doing nothing but repeating what I said earlier today. So I'm not going to do that to you, other than I'll finish as I started with, you know, ultimately, this is a decision for the legislature and the governor to consider. You know, we hope you found that, you know, our thoughts on possible effects on this enlightening or helpful as you go through discussion. The railroad is a key piece of infrastructure in this state. And I think, and yes, I know that sounds somewhat self-serving for me to be saying that, but as I'm saying, it's the added advantage of being the truth is what it is. And it's something that expansion of infrastructure in the state is something we take very seriously, something that we need, I think, to have happen for the state to actually, realize its full potential here. But again, it is going to take more than simply the Alaska Railroad. We are delighted to help lead the charge on this, but we need some serious supporting actors on this also.
Representative McKay.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to make a few comments. Again, getting back to the bill, talks about a resource development agreement. And frankly, I don't see why we need to sell the railroad to be able to do that. We could do that now. We could build a resource development agreement with the existing Alaska Railroad. I don't see why that couldn't happen now. I don't think we have to wait for a sale. Now, what I would also point out is Prudhoe Bay was announced as a major discovery in March of 68. The Hickel Highway, which later became, or parts of it became the Hall Road, construction was started in November of 68. So the resource was found, and then the infrastructure to get to it was built. So it's a chicken and the egg situation. They do talk about in the bill that we would build railroad spurs and rail lines to access resource-rich areas of the state. Great. But you have to know where they are. we don't throw a dart at the map. So I don't see why, Mr. O'Leary and Mr. Chairman, why we couldn't work on a resource development agreement now with you guys and see where that takes us. So that would be my advice, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thanks. So unless you have anything else, Mr. O'Leary, I would really like to thank you. I know you've been under the gun. You've been down here several times, probably just for me or for this committee, and put a lot of work into it, and Ms. Clemens as well. You guys have been fabulous, and I know this is maybe probably not exactly the path you would take, but as I said, we are struggling. You know the state's struggling. We're struggling with money. We don't have all the oil coming in, and we have a bunch of stranded resources, whether it be gas on the North Slope, Usabelli coal, the gold in up at the northern edge of the new proposed West Sitna access, could be trees in Nenana. I mean, there's all sorts of things that are just kind of swirling around this, and you're the key. So I'm hopeful that we can work something out, and I really do appreciate, I know you got a business to run, and I appreciate the way you do it, and you still kind of cater to us. So for that, I want to thank you. And I appreciate this presentation. So unless you have any closing, big bang closing statement, we'll let you off the hot seat, if you will. So
other than I have sworn never to be in Juneau towards the end of April in the past. But I appreciate very much those words. And we do appreciate the ability to come and talk to this committee and other committees. I think sometimes it's just very important to have these discussions. So we appreciate that. Thank you.
I agree. Okay, thanks. So seeing no other questions, everyone, I do appreciate you being here today. And I appreciate all the questions. Our next meeting will be Thursday, April 25th, when we will hear from ADA on financing infrastructure in Alaska. We will also hear HB 233 under bills previously heard and scheduled. And, oh joy, we will be having a Saturday meeting, April 27th, to hear SB 141 and possibly one other bill. So seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn and let the record reflect that the time is 2:50 p.m.